Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Football is back, and something big is coming. That's right. September 2nd, DraftKings Game Day arrives, and that is what you need. Game Day at DraftKings will be where it's at. And don't forget, we are now live in all 50 states. That's right, 50. One app, every sport, all 50 states. And new DraftKings customers, now you can sign up with code KSR and spend $5 and get $200 in rewards within 21 days. It includes all markets. That's right, all markets. That code is KSR in partnership with DraftKings. The crown is yours. And you can bet with DK Sportsbook.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 18 and over. Kentucky only. Eligibility and restrictions apply. $50 in non-withdrawable bonus bets issued every 7 days via click-to-claim for 21 days. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. For additional terms and responsible gaming resources, see sportsbook.draftkings.com/promos. Limited time offer.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here we are. We're going to solve the case as we always do every Friday on the Nancy Guthrie investigation. Nancy Guthrie is 84 years old. She has no known cryptocurrency holdings. She lives in the Catalina foothills, one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Tucson, and a $2 billion cybersecurity company just classified her alleged abduction as a wrench attack by proxy, a crime built around crypto extortion. So here's a question that nobody's been asking out loud yet, and I want to ask it today. What if whoever showed up at Nancy Guthrie's door that night was at the wrong house? And it's a wrench attack. And this is a mope. And once they were there, once an 84-year-old woman had seen them, they had a problem they couldn't walk away from. If that's what's happened, this isn't a case that the public thinks it is, and the real target may still be living in the neighborhood. Again, it's coming from the ethers of my brain. It's not coming from any verifiable information, but since we're hitting dead ends everywhere, I wanted to throw it out there. And joining us to have this conversation, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. So there you go. That's my layperson idea that came to my mind when I was like, what if it just was the wrong house? It would kind of lean into the wrench attack and a mope and somebody that's not super experienced in this and goes to the wrong house. Is it a crazy idea, Jen?
You know, look, everything has to be on the table at this point with what we have, but I don't think that that's probably very likely, and this is why. Part of the reason is I really believe this was well planned out, even in terms of the fact that they did those ransom demands the day after. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was just something like, whoa, I think now I'll do a ransom demand. I think it was well thought out. They knew the two Tucson stations they were going to send that to, which happened very quickly. 12 hours later, TMZ. I think this was just too well planned. And Savannah and her husband are worth over $45 million. It's the perfect target.
I agree. Let me ask you this about the ransom, because if we're connecting the ransom, and I've been always so probably too cautious on connecting the dots of the ransom to the actual crime itself. I've immediately been thinking this is all, you know, people, opportunists trying to get money. How do we know this? And maybe Robin could run a stat on this. When someone is kidnapped, how quickly, especially like in a higher profile, how quickly do those ransom demands start coming in? And how quickly do the fake ransom demands start coming in? Is this a relatively short period of time for the initial ransom demands to be an opportunist? Is it just too quick for someone to go, I'm going to take advantage of that?
Well, I can't wait to see what Robin comes up with, but
I've
I think
this one before.
It's going to be within 3 days.
Yeah.
That's my kind of recollection without stats in front of me. 3 days that a ransom demand, and obviously some are sooner. And remember, it also depends on who took them. Are we talking
within 24
about
hours?
Drug. Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
For legitimate ones?
60 to 75% within 24 hours, 48 hours, 85 to 90%. So everything within 48 hours for legit ones.
And if 12 hours is where they hit at, put some weight on them.
Yeah. So it's within legit.
Yeah.
I'll do a reverse now.
Sure.
It's within the legit. And I would say too, that the majority of those demands are gangbangers, drug dealers, people demand right away, because that's the majority of ransom demands that come in. That's just
within 24 hours for fake ones as well.
Interesting. Robin, what's your take on this idea, this theory that I have before we go to the next question? Because I'm curious to get your thoughts on me throwing that one out into the table.
So I like the idea that we're throwing another idea out there, definitely. Only because every single theory we have makes sense at the get-go, and then it falls off because it doesn't quite fit what we've seen from the background of Nancy, Savannah. I know we can, you know, make it kind of fit with a lot of things, but it's still, if you're looking at averages, it just keeps falling off. Now, if they completely got it wrong, because here's where I like about it. I like it for the wrench attack where they hired the mope, because the mope, you know, he was fluid on that front step, like he was there before ish. But at the same time, though, you know, I'm then riffing off of what Janice said before about taking the weeds and the branches and crap with a nest can. In other words, he seemed prepared for everything except that. That kind of lends to the fact that he wasn't ready for that house's front steps. I don't know. I like the idea of let's explore that a bit more. So the first thing that I thought of, Tony, when you said it, is like, all right, let's look at the background and people that surround her that are very close proximity. Does any one of those have any known crypto? What's their net worth? So I'd actually be looking a little bit more at that. And also, so here's what you, I don't know if they're doing this. They should have been doing this if they're not. I'd also then be doing at least one degree of separation from all her neighbors as well, because that's one way you can flush this out is like, all right, so let's look at all their gardeners, let's look at all their pool people, let's look at all these other people, one degree of separation, because if you got no more leads here, we can just expand that concentric circle out to the surrounding homes and see if any of that fits.
I guess my question would be, what kind of investigative reach do they have to take a look at neighbors, if they have crypto or if they have something like this where it would fit the wrench attack theory, but the person went to the damn wrong house. And I'm sorry, anybody in that neighborhood. I'm in no way in trying to insinuate that you had anything to do with this whatsoever. I'm just trying to think about, was someone else the intended target here? And if they were, that might be a little concerning too. if the someone else was taken and you were the intended target originally, that means they're still out there and so are you. So that would be a bit of a concern, I think, to anybody in the neighborhood if they went to the wrong person.
I don't think it'd be too hard to do it because, you know, all the neighbors have been pretty compliant. You just do a very structured interview of the information you're trying to flush out during that. What do you think, Jen?
Well, I agree with that. And I agree that they know whether Savannah has crypto or not. They knew that on, you know, day two. Somehow Certicay thinks they have it.
That's where I get good to Certicae.
Yep.
What do we know? Do we know anything more about the Certicae and their report that they released that lists Nancy in there as being a wrench attack more than we did last week, Jen? Have you found anything else out about how they got to that conclusion?
No, not anything more, but just I find it very interesting their nexus with other FBI investigations and the fact that they are able to really dial down on blockchains. And mm-hmm. in other words, blockchains that connect to other wallets that are suspicious. That's what they do. You know, it's really interesting. It's like a white collar crime squad. What does a white collar crime squad do? It analyzes different information it has regarding transactions that mm-hmm. call the attention different offices, right? And then that comes into the Bureau. So that's how I see Certicae too, is actually giving information to the Bureau. We know they do on different crypto security issues.
So had this kidnapping gone right, what would we have been looking at differently? What would have happened next that didn't happen here?
Oh, I love that question. I mean, what we're looking at is the fact that they could have given some sort of proof of life. And actually, maybe the Guthries would have paid. But I will caution that a lot of these ransoms are paid without proof of life. And they are paid, for instance, there's other ransoms that involve Bitcoin that don't have to do with life, but rather have to do of information, right? Information that other companies that they've got that companies want back, that they extort money from them, right?
So then what, what kept it from happening then? So if a lot of these things don't require a sign of life and Nancy had the money and they even said that they were willing to just retrieve her body, what kept everyone then from pulling the trigger if everyone thought this was legit?
You know what I think? I truly believe that the FBI would have said, don't do it without proof of life. And even though they always say it's a suggestion, we suggest this, this is what mm-hmm. we've seen. We don't want to feed kidnappers and we don't want to do that. And you don't have proof of life, blah, blah, blah. What are most people going to do? They are going to follow the direction. I can't think of one time we made a suggestion to a civilian about what they should or shouldn't do. And they didn't say, forget that. Sure. I'm going to do what I want. So I think that's why it wasn't done.
But what about now?
Well, now she's obviously, well, not obviously. It's a big possibility that she's gone. They still have those numbers, but has communication been lost other than that Bitcoin wallet? I don't think they're willing to risk it. I've always said, tickle the wire, send a significant amount, whether that's 100, 200,000, throw out some bait here. No one will do it. If they have done it, we don't know about it. And we would, because TMZ has the Bitcoin wallet number.
Do you think I'm all about just poking it, you know, and, you know, to get a stick and just poke the bear, see what it does. You know, what would it take? I don't think it would take much for someone to say, either Nancy or law enforcement, someone say, hey, all right, we've given up. We're ready to just pay some money. You know, is this good? I mean, if they've communicated through TMZ before, why not keep going? I mean, do you think that these people have given up on this and moved on? Or, I mean, just it's the lack of continued action on their part, which makes every element of this a little skeptical to me, because if they wanted money so bad and they went through this effort, get it, just do something to get it then. Or do they just typically move on?
Well, have they stopped? I keep saying there is no facts that those other six messages, approximately six messages that TMZ got. And if you listen to TMZ, they think that they're related. That's mm-hmm. what I, that they think it's related. Look, it's the exact same modus operandi, right? Nobody else is going in there because they know they can do it without getting caught, at least so far.
What I was surprised by early on was these messages going to the air. I mean, I know they didn't read them verbatim, but they were like, we got these messages. And the fact that, and there could have been two paths of how that got that way. Number one, they got the messages and they went to the air. Nothing in between. Like, we're going to get this. Of course, you know, we're going to let the FBI know, but we're going to get this out before they tell us not to. But they did it several times over. What I'm surprised by in that sort of a situation is, do you think the FBI advised TMZ or anything and said, look, if you get more, don't talk about it? Just, you know, because this happens in media organizations. Authorities do sometimes contact the organization that's reporting and saying, look, we know this is a back and forth with you. Shut up. Our goal here is to find this person. And in a case like this, I would think most entities would be like, I hear you. Okay, whatever I can do to help us, help you in this thing. It's not, you know, obstructing the investigation. And you have to have your journalistic ethics here of, do I report this? Do I not? I would think most would say, okay, let's not report this. Unless the FBI's thought was, this helps the case by putting this out there. I don't know. Do you think the FBI said when these letters came in, stop reporting about it? I know some of the TV stations didn't run with letters they got.
I think the FBI would have said, don't report this. Don't say anything. They don't.
You think they thought to say that? I'm wondering, like, if there was, like, not the right oversight there of, like, tell them to stop doing this.
Well, we saw in action the two initial statements, the local stations didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in large part why TMZ was reached out to by this same group 12 hours later.
Okay.
You know, they sent these letters, and that to me, and I, Robin, I really want to hear your take on this, because that to me shows a level of wanting to really hurt the Guthrie family, embarrass the Guthrie family, have this out there that it's not paid. And are they sophisticated enough to know the Bureau would say this? And so this is humiliation, or are they using this as a pressure. Look, it's out there. Everybody's seeing this. So it's time to pay.
Yeah. So it makes sense if the local stations weren't responding to their initial reach out, and then they escalated to national level. So I'm more on the crypto wrench side of these things than any retribution against Savannah or Nancy, only because of the lack of leakage prior and after. You know, if it's going to be anything, it's because, again, they're going for something in that house, and it just doesn't really fit behavior for retribution for me in any way. Yeah. But again, everything can fall off. But it makes sense that they would then escalate to TMZ, even though the probability of them doing this methodology and not going straight to the family is not the way it typically goes either. Because proof of life, I looked up the stat again, just reiterating, we've done it all before, it's like 90-95% of the time there's always proof of life provided on the immediate ransom, which they couldn't do. We assume they couldn't do. Something went sideways.
Jen, if they were to suddenly take the Bitcoin wallet that is sitting there that no one has accessed, that has a couple hundred something sitting in it, what if they were to take that, put like $100,000 in it, and it were to be withdrawn? How quickly could they determine who withdrew that and where it went to and where that person was? If they were to try this little experiment out,
it 100%. Depends on how they withdrew it. Did it go to another wallet and then to another wallet and then to another wallet and then out? And how did it get out? Remember, it has to go out either to be converted to francs or US dollars or, you know, whatever the currency is. But it can't stay in Bitcoin. It could stay in Bitcoin because Home Depot takes it and various restaurants now and everything. But that kind of money, you're going to want to have it more liquid. So to your question, it can possibly be traced, but it could be difficult depending on how it is finally makes it into currency. There could be so many steps.
Sure.
But like I said before, currency is hard to trace too. Yeah. You don't not do something because it's going to be difficult. That's how I
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not saying that because it'd be difficult, but is it even possible, or is there a clear out that whoever is playing with the money knows a way that, oh, you think you're being smart here, let me transfer it to this wallet, let me break it down into 40 more wallets, let me break all that down into 40 more wallets, and then we'll just kind of distribute it this way and that way, and eventually it will come out. And I mean, it's a lot of following the money, probably to a point where you can't follow the money. I'm not super versed in how all that world works other than what I'm kind of learning here, but it's not as clear cut as it would be of just putting $100,000 in that wallet, from what I'm hearing, and then waiting for someone to get a wild hair and think they're going to outsmart the system. There's probably ways to still outsmart the system, even.
Yeah.
With
so here's what I looked up while we're chatting. So wrench attacks, hard to solve. 25 to 40% result in arrests only, but they can trace the lack of any arrests recovered funds so far in Nancy case. And one reason why experts doubt it was some doubt it, but they can trace it to a certain extent, just like Jen was saying. But it's challenging. But again, 25 to 40% of the ones that are solved.
And Certitech, okay, that's what they do.
Yeah.
Right. That's the Bureau would not be doing this. This is not some agent sitting there.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely not.
This is Certitech, which is what their experts do every day. They're subject matter experts.
So there's a reason they're saying this. We just don't know the exact reason yet. But it seems to be this. Would you call this the strongest lead that's come out of this case so far? Seeing, I mean, at least from a digestible point of those of us on the outside trying to figure this thing out, would this be the strongest thing that you've seen for a signal coming out of this case?
Well, yeah, you know, I definitely went to paper on that a while back, so I'm sort of stuck with it now, no matter how it comes out. But I mean, that is our strongest signal. That's without a doubt. The strongest lead we in the public have, not being able to see the entirety of the case. Certitech is putting their reputation on the line. Could it be all just for some sort of, you know, publicity? Maybe. You know, I got to tell you, I am working on a couple of things in the background with that. More to come.
There's your tease. The tease. Now everyone sits on pins and needles waiting for what you discover. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of it. I'm sure we'll be talking about it next week. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. As we continue our conversation here, we're going to move over to another event of the week. Rex Heuermann. Judge called Rex Heuermann a disgusting, despicable coward and told his officers to get him out of the courtroom. The families chanted ogre as he was led away. That part felt right, but here's the part that doesn't feel right. Before any of that happened, Heuermann has agreed to sit down with the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit and walk them through everything, how we picked them up, how we killed them, how we got away with it for 17 years, and he's probably going to enjoy it. That's the part that makes your skin crawl. But I mean, the FBI has been doing this for 50 years, and they keep coming back to the table. There's a reason for that. And the reason is it's actually solved cases. So let's dive into this. And I can't think of better folks to do that with. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. So the judge told the guy he's a coward, threw him out of the courtroom. Same deal, though, gives him a seat across from the FBI where he gets to walk through every detail of what he did. And he's probably going to love it. Walk me through, Jen, I'll start with you, why the FBI wants a seat on the table with him anyway. And what sort of information might they glean off of old Rex?
Well, look, this is a salivation moment for anyone that is in the BAU. And quite frankly, for anyone, even me, who studies this, who investigates this sort of thing, I wish I could be there. Why? Mm-hmm. Not because I think anything of him. I have to plug my nose going in there. But you want to understand, he's a prolific serial killer. I know there's 8 bodies that have been attributed to him so far. I think there's going to be many more that he confesses to. And you got to when you look at somebody that's hiding in plain sight, an architect so well known, even on camera, you know, even though he by then had all of these victims, and actually somebody had seen him. Remember what, you know, there's that terrific witness. And yet he's on camera going out there living a normal life. You want to understand how somebody like that ticks. Is he 3 years old and can't wait to find an animal to kill? How many did he kill? What made him into the monster he became in that capability? So, I mean, this is an opportunity that they cannot turn down, and it does help with cases in the future.
Robin?
Yeah, everything Jen was saying, each one of these guys has a very unique aspect to him, but I think the most unique thing about Rex was the fact that he really controlled his entire environment. He was enacting all his sadistic crap in and taking advantage of these girls. I think definitely the way he targeted people is of a huge interest, how he even targeted who he's going to marry to provide his cover, how he controlled his environment. And I still think that they're going to be really looking at how he controlled multiple environments with all these other timeshares and places he had control of. And they're going to be looking at how his sadistic fantasy world evolved over time, how he evaded or attempted to evade law enforcement over time. How he was then outpaced by law enforcement. I mean, all these data points help create the profile, which is the filter by which we look at other cases through, thereby helping us. And we're getting, like in the Nancy Guthrie case, we're getting 20,000 to 30,000 leads in or even more. It helps you whittle these down. I'm not saying Nancy Guthrie obviously isn't a serial killer case, but in these types of cases, this is where it helps a lot.
What are some of the things they're looking to glean off of Rex? Like, for example, if they do learn he was, you know, killing puppies at 10 or whatever, you know, weird things he might have been doing in his childhood. You know, we've seen that in other killers and things of that nature. It gets added to the stats of, okay, here's another one who was doing these horrible things and then went down this sort of path. Other than adding to the stats of, okay, here's the type of recipe that makes this type of person, what does the FBI get out of it that they can then apply to other investigations, active investigations with other folks that they're looking at, that the investigation of Rex brought to light? Is it more so, oh, okay, tells us what other people are truly capable of, that the mind can do these sort of things? Give me some insight there, Jen, as to how this might then be applicable elsewhere.
Well, the number one thing is if he confesses and talks about other crimes. So that would be just huge for them to understand other girls that are missing, other people that were murdered. So that's number one. Number two piece of this, I know what you're talking about. We've heard the recipe before. There might be a few different ingredients, but his recipe is going to be that much different than some of the other prolific serial killers. But my whole thing is he did it differently. He called. He had burner phones. Mm-hmm. He specifically targeted in a way that not others targeted this way. He hunted in a different way. He was very intellectual in terms of how he did it. We haven't heard a lot about his voyeurism. I want to hear about that because that typically is such an aspect in these cases. We haven't heard about that. I also want to hear I know this seems gruesome, but I want to hear exactly what he did to these girls step by step to understand if that evolved. You know, we know some were dismembered, some weren't. Was that strictly because of, I talk about it, the pragmatic-ness that you need? That's why most people dismember, is you just get rid of a body, so you need to make it smaller to put it different places. How did he evolve from, you know, cutting them all up to changing his MO? All of that. We know a lot from what he wrote, but there's going to be so much more there.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, again, personally, on one of the things that I think is fascinating is how he targeted. Because what you can then use with that knowledge of how he targeted his victims is you can go to those victim groups in which he targeted, create law enforcement, creates those relationships, even in areas of society where people typically don't report these types of things or the creepy people, because we know he actually solicited prostitutes that he didn't kill. So how he selected them, when you can develop relationships inside these disenfranchised communities where they, you can get tips, leads, and leakage ahead of time from people like him or from other victims, you know, that's a huge thing you can do. And also, a huge aspect of him, which is very different, I think, from a lot of other serial killers. A lot of other serial killers were constricted by time, space, environment. They had to really hinder and rein themselves in so they couldn't be discovered because they didn't have as much control as Rex did. Rex completely owned his entire environment to a level I don't think we've really seen all that commonly. He owned the house and the room and had no one else had access to it for his entire life. That is huge. In other words, he allowed his twisted, sadistic, inhuman brain to run wild, and it had no constrictions on it. So that is a very unique, different optic. And so with interviewing that person, it creates a, I'd say, a more fuller, fleshed out profile of someone that if not constricted by anything, what would a sick bag of genetic goo do? I think that's where they're going to gain a lot of knowledge that they can then apply to protect others, to see the red flags coming up in these, because this is a very typical environment that they target in. You know, we've seen it in so many cases. That's why I think this, I'm very happy at least that we're, that this is getting so much attention, because these women in are I can't even, it's horrendous what happens because people don't listen to them.
Why do you think, Jen, that he didn't kill everyone that he came in contact with, every sex worker? I mean, what made him decide that this was going to be a kill versus I'm going to let live? That would be a question I would have if I were going in and asking questions here with the BAU. What's your take?
Oh, that's a huge question. You know, was there some sense of empathy that was reached with any of this? Was he having issues with getting it up? I'll just call it, you know, in other words, even though this is about domination and about force and all of that, and him being in control, it's also, there are other mechanical issues. So, you know, did empathy enter in? Did the mechanical problems enter in? Did the tables get turned where he never really felt that control? I, like I said, I'll be all over this. Actually, we won't ever probably see the report because the Bureau's doing it.
Right. So yeah. I do not think it was because empathy kicked in. He doesn't have any. He's incapable. I think, again, pure conjecture off the top of my head, the fantasy that he was envisioning wasn't being satisfied. For whatever reason, because he's very selective on the women he was choosing, because he assessed that they were going to give him the sadistic satisfaction with the responses they were giving him to his stimulus was satisfying to him. And for some reason, and again, I think all these other factors come in there too. It could be uninterrupted, who knows? But whatever it is, he wasn't being sadistically satisfied by the victim he had chosen.
They're calling the interviews that the BAU is going to do clinical interviews, not investigative. They were specific on that. And I know we were talking earlier about if he could reveal information in other cases. I'm sure he has a vested interest in not doing that, especially if they were to be in states that have the death penalty. But how, when the BAU goes in to have the conversations with him, what is their goals walking in the door before a word is said? Is it whatever we get? Is it, okay, we are certainly going to try to learn, you know, behavioral cues from this guy and understand that. But are they also going in with kind of a psychological backdoor tactic of, let's see if we can get him to reveal other cases without, you know, who else did you kill? You know, but more of a, well, let's see if he can accidentally trip him up and get him to say something. Is that part of the equation and the plan that they're planning as they go into those conversations?
Tony, they want it all.
Yeah.
They want it all, and they can call it clinical. They can call it psychological. They can call it non-investigate. They could call it whatever they want. They want it all. They want to understand everything he did, to who, when, what, where, how. I've always said this is going to take, I don't know how long for this. I mean, a year. It could be take a very long time, depending on how many days in a row they work, how many people are on this. But I think it's going to take a very long time to get down to everything.
Yeah, the number one goal they have is to create a relationship strong enough with him that he's going to not want to hide anything, not want to hide an agenda, that he's going to want to show off, because that is the only motivation that psychopathy has, is grandiosity. And so they have to go in there. They're going to, it's going to be a great strategy, interview strategy, about how to interview a very intelligent, high level psychopathy individual that committed multiple murders. And so the first thing they have to do is just focus on that. You're not going to get any information until his walls and shields and show is down enough that he feels that he's excited to show off, because that's literally only thing he cares about in the world is what I can show off. And he's very, and the big thing is he's going to keep it very contained to the bucket of information of which he's already admitted 8 murders.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And so he's going to be very strategic in how he leaks that out, because he's going to want to keep getting attention. He's not going to just say, here it all is. Here it is in a 1-2-6 hour interview or 24 hour. It's going to go on as long as he can string it along. And so the Bureau is also going to be part of the interview strategy, is the patience, the patience, the patience, while making progress, 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 to keep him escalating and keep the drive and want, desire for him to show off. So they're going to have to validate him, get those shields down, show off, but then they're going to have to go back with, yeah, that's really interesting, Rex, but you know, it's still not as good as BTK. No, you're just not there yet. So he's going to want to have to one-upsmanship everyone every time. So it's a lot that they have to hold in their side, a lot on his side. So it's nonstop dancing for years.
If he knows that going in, though, he's not an idiot, obviously. We know that. I mean, so he knows going in, the FBI talking to him, they want to find out about the other ones if he has more to hide. He knows it's more than just talking about those 8. If he knows that, what's his incentive to say anything other than he agreed to it? He's got nothing to lose anymore. I mean, is there any repercussions if he just tells them to F off when they come calling? Like, that's nice. Like, I don't have to say anything to you. And what are you going to do? Lock me up forever? I mean, is there, are there repercussions if he were not to say anything? Could there be anything that he would face while in prison or throughout the legal system for not taking part in these interviews? Or is it kind of a moot point?
Well, yeah, they can revoke the plea, make him go through trial. I mean, they can revoke it.
Okay. Even if it, like, a year from now or whatever, he just decides I'm not talking anymore?
I mean, you wouldn't see that. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
I really haven't, not in a case like this, but I'm just saying that could happen. But I think he's going to like this. I really do.
Yeah.
As long as they don't walk in and say, yo, ogre. I mean, Robin, you need to be, you know, really work this up with two amazing rapport. And you don't know when you go in there who is going to be able to establish that. The agents, who is actually going to somehow make that connection. But yeah, they're going to be, there is going to be a psyop.
You're right, because he's going to give enough information if whoever goes in there and gets that relationship with him, that's going to give him a brain reward. I mean, he's going to get the dopamine, the serotonin, the oxytocin. You know, all the brains are going to be firing when he's giving up information and being validated for that information. And now, how the Bureau keeps him talking? Ignore him. After he's addicted to sharing, because literally this is the only thing in life he has left, is the fantasy in which he has, and to impress people with that sadistic fantasy world he has. So if he gets sharing information, people are listening to him, writing notes, making him feel important, and all of a sudden he gets ignored, it's going to piss him off. He's going to come back.
I was going to ask you, Robin, how do you inspire him to talk? Is that it?
Ignore him.
All right. Jen?
Because that's it.
I think he's chomping at the bit to talk.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine being able to play this out, having the FBI listening to you, writing down your every word. you know what's going to go on back in his cell when he gets back in there. I mean, this is exciting for him. He's in control.
So here's a prediction. I guarantee you one of the first questions he's asking people right now is, when's the FBI coming? He's very excited for it. I guarantee you he's excited for it.
And some other levers. I totally agree with Robin, by the way, on all of this. But some other levers are where he is going to be. So right now they've already moved him. And that is something the Bureau works very closely with a Bureau of Prisons with. And it's there's some nice rewards that can be done in that realm. And that's usually what these guys care about.
What kind of rewards? And
the pasta buffet from the look of them. He likes his Twinkies, man. That's what they're going to reward him with. Interviewer's going to go in there with a big applause machine and a box of Twinkies, man. He won't shut up.
We opened a macaroni grill down the hall just for you.
No, I need the patient to be close to where he wants to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be fascinating to see where this goes and what information comes out in the coming years on it. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack and YouTube. The links are in the descriptions. One more case to talk about today. Timothy Hudson. He is the young man who has been accused of taking the life of his stepsister, Anna Kempner. He walked free for months. 16 years old, charged as an adult now with killing his stepsister, Anna Kempner, on that Carnival cruise ship. And a federal judge said ankle monitor initially. Go live with your uncle. Go do some landscaping. That has now changed. Same judge wrote a 14-page order calling Hudson a danger that no curfew or monitor could contain. Used the word psychopathy and said he could snap at any time. Sealed evidence nobody has seen landed on the docket 2 days before that order. And there were reportedly warnings about Hudson's behavior toward Anna before the family ever stepped in from that ship. So there we are. Here's where we're at. He's now in custody. Same judge doing the same stuff. Interesting. Joining me to discuss, we have Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, and Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. What changed? What do you think was in those docs that made him from being a lovely landscaper to he could snap at any time? I mean, this is a dramatic shift I'm seeing here. Jen, your thoughts?
I think it's two things going on. First of all, this magistrate judge, federal magistrate judges see few cases like this. They don't see 16-year-olds almost ever in their career because the federal system does not handle juveniles. This was decided it would be handled federally, and this sort of case is so rare. So any judge hasn't seen it, and I think that's part of this. I really do, in terms of his understanding of the wackadoodle nature of somebody that can do this and what they did to Ann and Kempner, combined with what is in that sealed information that was submitted by the prosecution office. I mean, come on. All of us have been saying this. To me, how in the hell can you not think somebody that strangles somebody so hard that blood is coming out of their ears and they're 16 and then they just throw them under the bed with life jackets, that this person is capable of doing that or to somebody else? So I can buy, but finally they got through to the judge. Finally, they put enough details that he said, oh, yeah, maybe this is a problem.
Yeah, my guess is school records and documentation about inconsistent, chaotic violence and behavior, anger issues that were documented. And so in order for them to have a reversal that fast, I would say it. A lot of people have been, when you're a kid and you're in school, there's a lot of behavior that's observed, whether it was documented or they had a lot of testimony by people around him in his life. That to me is what probably did it.
Is that then, I mean, really the fault of the DA or the prosecutors in this case of not turning in complete work, if you will? It's like, okay, you have to write more than just a sentence here, you know, when you're in grade school, and it's like, you need to show your work. Is that kind of what was going on here? They didn't show enough work to the judge for the judge to go, oh, this really is a dangerous human being. Like, should they have gone on maybe a little bit stronger with examples of why he should be locked away initially, and not just assume the judge is going to look at the blatant evidence that says that, but maybe he needed the extra little shove?
Well, one of the things they talked about was actually his interview, right? His psychology or his mental health evaluation. So I'm wondering what he said in that. I mean, does he talk about how he still fantasizes about others? He was in the house with other little girls. Hello. Mm-hmm. How, you know, I'm just so glad this prosecution team said, all right, like you said, we got to show the work. We got to get everything or we're never going to convince this judge. And that's what they went to school and did, thankfully.
Yeah, it guaranteed it was probably that, you know, this other important basket of genetic goo. It was probably very easy to get all the evidence they needed from him because he can't help being who he is because he's so broken that every time you ask him a question, it just spurts out of that teenage mouth. And he's good. Good. So, yeah, they had to do a little extra work because they didn't understand why the judge wouldn't just throw him behind bars because he's such a danger. But it wasn't hard to prove he was a danger, I don't think.
I mean, the judge's words were rather striking in the order. A level of psychopathy and lack of remorse in the pretrial order, and said Hudson could snap at any time. Mm-hmm. What the hell do you think? I mean, for one's own self-preservation while being questioned, you know, people try to present their best side. Apparently, he wasn't very good at even doing that. I mean, what do you think he revealed in these psychological tests that led the judge to have that type of a reaction? Jen?
Well, Tony, to Robin's point, working gangs all those years with these younger people, I love to interview them. It's shocking. They just tell it like it is. Like they have no or not enough experience to understand what to say and what not to say. And as long as you're a decent interviewer, you build great rapport with them. You're empathetic to their situation. They're just verbal diarrhea with what their plans are, what they would have done, and they don't seem to get it. And I think that's what happened here.
Yeah, so I agree. And whether it happened in an interview room during the testing where he went from 0 to 100, in other words, every time we've seen something like this, it's part of it is a zero ability to problem solve. They go from zero to violence. And so something could have been going really right. Someone asked him a question in an interview and he went to immediately defensiveness, anger, violence, threw pencils, pens, whatever it was. Or it's also documented in something they looked at in school records or in other interviews with other people. Because for that response by the judge was triggered by something he read that actually is exactly that. It was not conjecture. This is actually documented from something somewhere and probably multiple times. It wasn't just a one-off.
In a lot of cases, you have parents that will stand by their child, even if they know what they did was wrong. That's not the case in this case specifically. Mom and stepdad are all too happy, it seems, to throw him in front of the oncoming freight train. And there's been a lot of talk, and we've talked about it, of you know, should the parents be charged? Can the parents be charged? Is there even a lever to pull? And it really appears there's not much. I mean, maybe he's missed him. But likely, probably not. But the fact, though, is, you know, there's this image there that there was stuff that was going on in that house that was not there were red flags that were ignored or looked past or not understood for what they were. Who knows what it may be? Does the prosecution have an interest here to try and get in contact to have a conversation with those parents who I'm sure are probably a bit concerned of their own charges coming their own way for their parenting skills? I'm sure that's in the back of their mind, whether it has legs or not. But would it be advantageous? Because some of the most impactful information on the history of this kid, the context of this kid leading up to this crime, is going to come from mom and dad. And if mom and dad have, oh, I don't know, immunity from prosecution, they might be all too happy to pour gasoline on the child they threw in front of the oncoming freight train as well. Do you think there's an interest there with investigators to get them to talk and really spill the beans on the monster that was among them, allegedly?
You know, this would be my guard and concern if I were interviewing them. I just don't know how honest these people really are.
Yeah.
I think that that would be a big issue for me, knowing whether I could really trust anything out of their mouths, even with immunity. I think everything would be guarded. But having said that, a bigger point I think you bring up is, and I do agree that oftentimes these monsters are just monsters. There's some people that are just bad, but typically there's a lot of forces in upbringing that kind of pour fertilizer on all of that. And with this, I just wondered, did this kid have any good parenting, meaning were they loved? Did they understand what was going on in his life? Did they care? Did they talk to him every day? Did they hold him when he hurt? Did they listen to him? And then when he became the monster and they started hearing stuff about this, did they say, I got to get this kid in counseling and I got to get him out of this house? They couldn't even get him out of the stateroom of the girl of his, you know, obsession. So I have a feeling all the answers are no to that. But you look, he's 16 years old. There's, to me, a lot probably in his background that those parents aren't going to want to talk about. That's my belief.
Yeah. And I 100% agree, but you definitely want to talk to them, because I think the people around the parents, friends, family, coworkers, there's always leakage. Mm-hmm. And so those are the people I really want to talk to, because if you, I mean, what parent, when you actually have some relationships with people at home, work, and play, and you're going to functions and people are talking about their kids all the time, there's going to be leakage about the stuff they're dealing with at home most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time. So I'm going to be, again, those people you're interviewing are going to be a lot more objective about what they heard and what they saw than the parents themselves, because they have their own agenda going of self-protection.
They do. I mean, and there's a lot of reason for that. You still have the father, the ex-husband of the wife, of the mother of the alleged killer that has been fighting for custody. He may have a civil interest in this. There's a lot of possible levers here where I think you could probably get a lot of information out of the parents if they knew they were protected from the prosecution of it. And rather than just pleading the fifth on the stand and not self-incriminating bad parenting. So I just wonder if you put that cookie out there for them, if they'd bite, and it would get you more information. But I guess the other question too is,
maybe,
how much do you need? I mean, do you need much more than him being on camera, going into the room and not coming out and she's dead? I mean, it pretty much answers the question. Do we need the, you know, philosophical history on the child of everything he's done, you know, since age zero?
I mean, Jen, we're all parents. Jen, you're a parent, you know, Tony, you're a parent. I mean, at this point, I think they just want to crawl under a rock and go away.
Yeah.
I mean, so I don't think there's anything, unless they're going to be charged with something, I don't think there's anything that can compel them. At least, you keep reversing that. It's like, all right, I'm in a situation. I've demonstrated how I don't want to be involved with this anymore because, you know, we kind of like distancing ourselves from them. And you're not going to charge me? Why would I talk? Everyone in the world's already criticizing the living hell out of us being bad parents, and there's not one thing I could say that's going to make it better at this point.
True. Yeah, it still goes back to self-preservation there, not just burying him.
Yeah, just get away. I think they're in getaway mode.
Now, I do think the BAU, they would be interested in talking to them. That would be a very good conversation, and actually something that they could do, which would be honorable for once.
That'd be very interesting.
Honorable.
Yeah, I agree with that, because again, each one of these cases, there are people around them that saw an awful lot of behaviors before things went south and sideways. And especially, you know, our society's been evolving it hasn't been evolving. It's been changing rapidly as a species. We don't evolve that fast. It's been changing rapidly because of online, because of AI, all these things. And the COVID lockdown years had a huge significant impact on mental health, problem solving skills. And so people are taking a lot of data about the current younger generations, about how they're facing life and the stressors they're facing, and their lack of decision-making capabilities, and how their brains are being formed and malformed much differently than they have in the past, I think. And so anything they can glean from anyone around him is really vital.
It'll be fascinating. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. Jennifer Coffendaffer, as always, thank you for being here. Check out Break the Case, Jennifer Coffendaffer YouTube, and wherever you get podcasts, go there, press subscribe, and check it all out. Robin Drake, his latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books and audiobooks, and leave a review there as well. Go and check that out. And like I said, please do press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations. Until next time, for Robin, for Jennifer, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm gonna be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.